This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, and you know what that means. It is our week in review. Politicians making big moves, starting with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu's new vaccine rules, which go into effect tomorrow.
The reason we're doing this across the board is so that it is clear this is city policy. This is not the decision of our individual hostesses and waiters and staff at various venues.
She may be doing it across the board, but not everyone is on board, like the head of the Massachusetts Small Business Association.
This is best left up to the businesses to make these decisions, that it should be up to a business to decide how they want to deal with their customers and their workforce and how they plan to keep people safe.
Meanwhile, Governor Baker making some big moves of his own, promising millions more antigen tests, deploying the National Guard to pitch in hospitals, and doubling down on his assertion that schools are safe.
I'm not going to let people perpetuate this idea that schools aren't safe, because they are. And it's been proven not just in Massachusetts, but in the U.S. and around the world for the better part of a year and a half.
But tensions, not to mention student and teacher absences, running high. And Dr. Eric Dixon of UMass Memorial tells us why.
It's hard to imagine that here in the most vaccinated state in the country, we are dealing with the worst of the three COVID surges.
So, another week heavily impacted by the pandemic, but it was far from the only subject with big moves this week. Mayor Wu also moved the tent encampments out of the area called Mass and Cass. Two mixed reactions.
I don't believe the city's going to doing enough to get to help everybody.
For us, this is like, you know, Christmas and 4th of July all together, okay?
And former Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins moves offices. She is now U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts.
I want to be educating people about the exceptional work that this office does, and I hope there's more opportunities now for me to do that than maybe previous administrations.
So much to cover. So let's dive in with our expert panel. This week, we are joined by Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus and president of Isaacson Political Consulting. Arlene, welcome back for Week in Review.
Hi, nice to be with you and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Also with us, media analyst John Carroll. John, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here.
And listeners, we are going to start with the big moves by Boston Mayor Michelle Wu this week. Are you on board with the vaccine mandate with no testing exception for city employees in Boston? Are you more or less likely to go to a Boston restaurant or entertainment venue when you'll have to show proof of vaccination? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. John, Arlene, that is where I want to start with the move on vaccine rules from Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. Two pieces, requirement for city workers, no testing option, and proof of vaccine for entertainment venues, restaurants, bars, gyms. Also, employees in those facilities have to be vaccinated. Arlene, right thing to do?
Absolutely. I'm glad the judge decided as he did. I personally would not want a cop approaching me, whether I was in my car or on the street. I wouldn't want them coming near me if they're not vaccinated. And I can't imagine if you're an immunocompromised driver and you get stopped because your taillight is out and an unvaccinated cop comes to your car window to speak to you. What if that cop gave him COVID? He ends up on a ventilator or worse, dies. I can't imagine the cop would say, well, sorry, but it was worthwhile because at least I didn't have to get vaxxed. I assume the cop would feel terrible about that, as well they should.
Go ahead, Arlene.
No, ditto for the firefighters. And so I think that, you know, it's not simply a question of killing someone. It's a question of filling up hospitals. When the surge started, I actually texted my two daughters and said, please be careful during the surge for the next two or so months. Please do make sure you are very safe in everything you do, whether you're cutting vegetables in the kitchen or driving your car, so that you don't have to go to an emergency room for anything, because there's no room at the inn.
So when you listen to that, John Carroll, when you hear Arlene talk about that, that is a wildly unsafe environment that requires these kinds of rules. That gets juxtaposed with showing your papers, basically, to get into a restaurant or a sporting venue. How to think about that balance? And I know using showing your papers is a little bit inflammatory. I'm doing that on purpose to kind of underscore where the tensions are here, John.
Well, it boils down to sort of a cultural war basically, that that there are people who just don't want to be told what to do. I just want to go back to the city employees for a moment, because the argument that the unions were making was that this was a unilateral change in their collective bargaining agreement, and that the previous agreement had been worked out for weekly tests or vaccination. The public health people are saying, look, you know, weekly testing doesn't work anymore. There still is this issue, though, of going in and essentially changing the rules in midstream. So you can approve of that or not approve of that, but that's an element that's at play. And the possibility is that 353 firefighters may be missing from the firehouses in Boston, which is itself a public safety issue. So it's a little more complicated than just, I don't want a cop coming up to me in case he's got coronavirus.
Arlene, do you want to respond to that before I go on?
There's also the issue of the ramifications of having all these unvaccinated city workers. You know, for the nurses, for the people who work in the hospitals, for the nurses and doctors who are physically exhausted and emotionally drained. And I think the police need to be more sympathetic to them, because most of the nurses who are working nonstop for patients, the majority of whom are not vaccinated.
So I got you. Go ahead and clear your throat there, Arlene. I'm going through the same thing. I've been hitting the cough button and clearing my throat a bunch. I want to clarify a couple things, John, you just said. First, Suffolk Superior Court found against the unions earlier this week and upheld Mayor Wu's mandate for city workers. I also want to note you said it is a change, and it is. Former Boston Acting Mayor Kim Janey had put into effect a vaccine mandate for city workers that allowed for testing in mid-December. Mayor Wu took out the allowance for testing and said, no, it's just straight up vaccination. So we've been talking so far about the requirement for city workers. There is this other piece, too, which is the requirement of proof of vaccination for a wide variety of entertainment venues in the city of Boston. And I want to be very mindful that that goes hand in hand with basically a vaccine requirement for the people who work in those facilities. So if you work there, you don't have the option to not be vaccinated. You have to get your shot to continue to work there. If you're a customer, you have choice. John, you said a minute ago, you know, this is culture wars. I do want to play a little sound that is about sort of personal and local control here. This is Christopher Carlozzi. He's the state director of the Massachusetts Small Business Association. Doesn't agree with the citywide requirement, not in principle, but because he thinks businesses should get to choose.
This is best left up to the businesses to make these decisions, that it should be up to a business to decide how they want to deal with their customers and their workforce and how they plan to keep people safe. They've done it throughout the pandemic. We've seen businesses take the lead in many cases, and we've seen businesses do things that fit their business best. And you may have larger facilities, you may have smaller businesses, where a one-size-fits-all mandate just doesn't work.
So I'm going to add one more thing in here, John Carroll, and come back to you to your point about complexity. So there's Carlozzi saying, hey, it's got to work for the local business. On the other hand, we do have a surge in our hospitals that we need to be mindful of. So there are these ancillary and very real public health effects. Here's Dr. Eric Dixon, CEO of UMass Memorial Healthcare, talking about how the surge for him, for his hospital, has been the worst of his pandemic, the pandemic, and more than his facility can handle.
We had peaked in the first surge at 350 patients in central Massachusetts, 385 on the second surge, and we broke 450 today. And that's taking up a major piece of the bed capacity here in central Mass, leading to long, long waits in the emergency department. At 25 patients waiting for an ICU bed. All of the ICU beds were full. We had run out of beds.
So I hear two people making understandable arguments based on their work, John, and yet essentially somewhat competing claims.
Right. And let me just say, I have the utmost sympathy for and respect and admiration for healthcare workers who have worked through this for, what is it? It's almost 2 years now. It's a really difficult job. And it's, in a way, it's an infuriating job because so many of the people that they're dealing with are unvaccinated. That said, you know, the small businesses I can understand how they feel. They've been through a very difficult 2 years as well. Unfortunately, this pandemic has brought out the worst in people. And I think that that is a problem that that can't really be fixed, but it can be addressed to some degree with these kinds of mandates. People are just not behaving responsibly in so many different ways. And I think that, you know, there comes a time when the state gets to say, you know, we're going to direct you to act more responsibly and more civic mindedly in terms of your fellow citizens. And so as much as you don't like to see these kinds of mandates, in a way, the city is trying to protect people from themselves in many ways. And I think that that's a legitimate thing to do.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. Your reactions by the moves by Boston Mayor Michelle Wu to put vaccine proof requirements and vaccine mandates in place in the city of Boston. Arlene, go ahead.
I think there's two other aspects to consider for the small business folks. The ones that I've talked to who welcome a mandate because they don't want to be put in the position of having to duke it out with customers who they'd really rather please by saying, in my business, you must wear a mask. Additionally, they don't want the customer to go next door to a different business who says, no, you don't have to wear a mask when you come into my company. You don't want them to have to compete and rush, you know, have a race to the bottom, if you will, of the standards they use when it comes to masks. And it's preposterous to suggest, for the governor to suggest, do what you want to do, decide yourself, that's a good public health policy, because it clearly is not.
So, you know, this individual discretion question, we had Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here on the show yesterday talking about what goes into effect on Saturday. And I talked to her about enforcement. And I said, you know, you have been taking the heat of bitter protest here. You know what this feels like when people are angry with you about these mandates. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. But I asked her, so how do you support the waitress or the hostess or the ticket taker who then has to enforce this in an individual business? And here was her response.
The reason we're doing this across the board is so that it is clear this is city policy. This is not the decision of our individual hostesses and waiters and staff at various venues. In other cities that have implemented similar policies, once it becomes widely known, the culture shifts and it becomes something that folks don't give a second thought to.
So, Arlene, is that going to work, especially given that, yes, you can't go next door to the next restaurant and, you know, not have to provide proof of vaccination, but you can go to Moody Street in Waltham and not have to provide proof of vaccination?
Well, you know, it's true. You can drive to another town, but we are lucky in the city of Boston that in most cases, people are going to Boston places because they want to be in the city of Boston. It's not foolproof, which is why I wish the governor, instead of doing a mask advisory, would do a mask mandate, because then he would protect against that exact phenomenon you're describing.
So, John, I want to stay. Oh, actually, let's grab a call here. 800-423-8255. We've got Lisa on the line in Peabody. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, Christiana. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with the mayor, and I wish more cities around, even in the suburbs, would do the same. The majority of the people are fully vaccinated. If I want to go out with my family, I want to feel protected. I think they're doing a great move. And if businesses don't want to survive, let them close. It's that easy.
Lisa, thanks for that call. So very strong feelings there from a caller. John, I want to stay on this idea of strong feelings. And you talked earlier about, you know, the politicization of this. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu has just, the pushback has been stunning. And of course, there is a racial dimension to that. And we talked about that in Week in Review, actually, last week. One of the new pieces of news this week, Boston Globe reporting protesters outside her home at 7 o'clock in the morning with a bullhorn, yelling at her house. We are in a new era there. And so I asked her how she was doing. Here's her answer.
You know, it's something to wake up or to start your day with a reminder of just how much emotion is out in the world and how much misinformation fuels a lot of that emotion. But I know we're doing the right thing here.
So, John, are we going to get to a point where we're not doing bullhorns outside her house in disagreement, or are we so politicized as we enter this third calendar year of this pandemic that in December we're still going to be having this conversation?
I think we're still going to be having this conversation. This is happening all over the place. I mean, this happened to Charlie Baker with climate change activists camping out in front of his house. It's happened to Joe Manchin down in D.C. He lives on a houseboat on the Potomac, and they're kayakers. They're called kayaktivists who are buzzing his houseboat, protesting that he won't vote for climate change action. There's all kinds of individual, personal issues here that people are taking right to the source. And I think that there's nothing that the police can do as long as they don't trespass and they don't make violent threats and they don't violate any curfew on noise, for instance. But I think that the ugliness just feeds into the increasingly tribal nature of society. And the fact that people will take extreme action at this point, sort of as a matter of course, is something that's concerning, because, you know, people don't always control themselves as well as they should. And we know what happens when there's a mob mentality. And so, you know, you would hope that they would continue to show restraint, but I'm not at all sure that that's going to be what happens.
All right. I'm going to go ahead, Arlene. Go.
I think it's noteworthy that the unions that are complaining to and going after the mayor about it are the most conservative. They are the unions that represent the most conservative membership, the police and the firefighters. They are candidly most likely to be where the Trump supporting union members would be found, as opposed to the many, many, many majority of other labor unions who feel very differently about the mandate question. Last year, I was walking by the State House one day when there was an anti-vaxxer rally, anti-mandate rally. I was wearing a mask at that point. It was pre-vaccine. It was a mandate about masks. And I was walking by it, and they started yelling at me because I was wearing a mask. And I have honestly, I've been to a lot of, I've worked on a lot of controversial issues, but I have never been called the B word or the C word more than I was at that moment walking by that demonstration. So the vitriol is there, and it is sort of that culture war John was referring to.
I'm sorry that happened. I'm going to take a couple of callers to give us the last word on this. Then we'll go to a break. We've got Stephanie on the line in Boston. Stephanie, go ahead.
Good afternoon. So I am a Boston Public School teacher. I am also vaccinated, so I'm not an anti-vaxxer by any stretch. But I just want to push back against this narrative that a mandate protects people from getting COVID. There's a number of breakthrough cases. I had COVID last week. A lot of my colleagues also have COVID. And a lot of my colleagues who are vaccinated are afraid of getting COVID with the number of staff and students that we have out. So I heard one of your guests say she would hate for a police officer to pull someone over and give them COVID because they're unvaccinated. But that could also happen with a vaccinated police officer. And I think it's dangerous to spin that narrative just to enforce mandates or say that mandates are good.
Well, Stephanie, I appreciate that. I do want to note, and I've been very public about this here on air, I also had a breakthrough case, vaccinated and boosted, and had a breakthrough case. Arlene, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that. And I'll note, you know, Dr. Anthony Fauci said in an interview earlier this week, Omicron may well hit most of us. So it will be. The difference is vaccination continues to protect you well from serious illness, hospitalization, and death. I want to note that. I feel it's responsible to note that. But Arlene, what about Stephanie's point? I'll actually give you
She makes a fair point, and I agree with her that is true. And so to a certain extent, I stand corrected, except for the notion that unvaccinated people are more dangerous to be around. And it is the unvaccinated people that are filling up our hospitals. And if the hospitals weren't dealing with unvaccinated people for COVID, there wouldn't be a crisis for our healthcare professionals, our nurses, and our doctors.
Still with us, media analyst John Carroll and Arlene Isaacson of Isaacson Political Consulting, and of course you. We will start this segment talking for a few minutes about the move by the city of Boston to clear out the tent encampments at the intersection neighborhood around Melnea Cass Boulevard and Massachusetts Avenue, and whether that response to the homelessness, mental health, and addiction crisis that is regional but concentrated there is the right next step. 1-800-423-8255 to share your thoughts on that. So, John Carroll, the encampments are gone. Mayor Wu has said, I wanted to use a public health approach here. Has it been humane and appropriate?
I think she's done a good job. Yeah, this started back in October. She laid out the plan that she wanted to follow. Last month, she said, basically, we want to get this done by the middle of January. And that's what she's done. So I think she's done a good job in organizing it. I think it was wise to split up as much as possible the 154 people into different facilities. So there are maybe 20 or 30 in individual facilities, not more than that. There's obviously still a problem there. There's a homeless shelter there, and there's still an open air drug market that's going on there. But I also just want to add, you know, to put this in perspective, to look at similar sized cities to Boston, such as Seattle. I mean, they've cleared 1,200 tents since the pandemic started. According to the CBS affiliate in Portland, Oregon, they cleared out 5 years ago 3,100 homeless camps. You know, it went down the next year to 2,800, then to 2,100. I mean, it's a staggering problem in other cities. So in Boston itself, it hasn't been as difficult, really, to get a grip on it, get a handle on it, and to somehow try to help these people who are homeless and out in the elements in the wintertime. I think that's the key.
So, Arlene Isaacson, let's do the yin and yang here. So John lays out the pieces of this that have been quite successful, well over 100 people into a lot of housing, low threshold housing, which usually means that you're allowed in the housing even if you might still be actively using. Let's say you're experiencing addiction. At the same time, WBUR's Deborah Becker spoke with people on the street that day. She's been covering it for a while. Here's just an example. One man who would only give his first name, James, who said he'd been living in the encampment for about 6 months and after Wednesday had nowhere to go.
And I don't believe the city's going doing enough to get to help everybody, to help all of us. I don't believe they're doing enough. I really don't.
So what are you going to do, like, tonight?
Well, I'm just going to have to wait. I have to try to get into the shelter here tonight, you know, and just, like, see what's happening from here.
Have you asked anyone about finding
housing? Oh, yeah. I've been out here asking, but it's still a wait list. It's nothing's guaranteed. Nothing's guaranteed. It's not like they'll tell you today and then tomorrow you're in a place.
So there's WBUR's Deb Becker's reporting. Boston Globe, Arlene, also had more than one article with interviews with people saying, I lost all my goods. Somebody reached out to me a few weeks ago. There was no follow-up. Now I have no place to go. Is that what is going to happen? I do not mean to be dispassionate or disrespectful. Is that what is going to happen in a situation this complex? Or is that a mark of a failure to do it right? I mean, these are hard things, Arlene.
Well, you know, I don't know that I can give you the yin yang. It might be yin and yin, because I actually think that Michelle Wu has done a really excellent job on this. She had promised to have the tents removed by mid-January, and she's done that. She promised to deal with it in the exact words you used, humane, public health focused way, using social workers rather than law enforcement approaches. And she's done that. She's focused on finding housing and shelter, albeit temporary, and she's done that. But she also was very honest about she has not solved the problem of homelessness in the city, and there's miles to go before we rest on that front.
So let's grab a call here, 1-800-423-8255. Luis is calling from Roxbury. Luis, go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm calling because they have not removed the tents, and maybe they shouldn't remove the tents until we get some support. I think it's unfair to the city of Boston that the governor has failed to do his job. The state has more than 10 facilities. There are old mental facilities. There are old schools that they could have moved people to. 65% of the people at MasterCast are not residents from Boston originally. So the state really should chip in and do its fair share. Wu's doing what she can and the best she can, but there are resources available in the state, and they should be the partner that they need to be in order to deal with the humanitarian issues that exist there. They're doing it in other states. Massachusetts has given Baker a free pass. They've not held them anything, including what happened in the nursing homes and the senior facilities.
So, Luis, I'm going to stay focused on Mass and Cass here. Thank you for your call. Now, listen, I have not been there since Sunday, but my understanding from reporting from WBUR's Deborah Becker is that they, in fact, have removed the tents. But what I'll focus on with you, John Carroll, is Luis's point that this is a regional problem. And in fact, Deb, in her reporting yesterday, told us that she understands, and Monica Burrell, who's advising Mayor Wu on this, said in the press conference yesterday, people are coming into the area seeking services as Mayor Wu is doing this work. Has the state been left off the hook here? And is there more they should be doing? This is a regional problem.
Well, if they have been doing anything, I'm not aware of it. They certainly haven't publicized it. This is a regional problem because there is a displacement issue here. You know, it's possible that a number of the people who were just moved and resettled from Mass and Cass are going to wind up somewhere else on the street. And it'll be a sort of a moving target for different cities and towns to try to keep on top of. I think it would be good if the state would put some resources toward this and help out the cities and towns. Because as you say, as Mayor Wu says, you know, homelessness is not going away. It may just be shifting locations at this point in slow motion.
All right. So on that note, I am going to shift gears. Luis gave us a chance to shift gears to Governor Baker, which I do want to do. So new calls now. Let's talk about moves Governor Charlie Baker is and is not making, especially in the context of the fact that he is now not running for reelection. This is his last 12 months. Will we see him be unfettered? Will we see him take on new priorities? What do you want to see from him in the last 12 months? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Arlene, I know you're aware that there was a hearing the legislature held earlier this week pressing Governor Baker on his response on COVID, not satisfied with it, pushing him very hard. And I wonder, do you think the governor is getting a pass where he shouldn't?
Well, you know, I think the governor did a very good job in 2020 when the pandemic was new. But his recent comments about schools and teachers, I think his disdain for teachers and their unions is sort of bleeding into his public policy statements. He's recently sounded very testy, cranky, arrogant even, in a way that some people I know find to be very offensive, where he tries to make it sound like he cares more about the kids in school than the people who've dedicated their lives to working with children, which is obviously not the case. So, you know, when he asserts with self-righteous indignation that the schools are safe and everyone should know that, well, I'm willing to bet that he would not want to spend the next 2 months, day after day, in a schoolroom himself, filled with 30 little kids, many of whom are not vaccinated, and helping them put on their masks and use the bathroom and dry their tears and work closely with them to help correct the papers as they write them. And I doubt he'd want his family to do it either. So especially when there aren't enough tests available for people. So I think he needs to show a little bit more flexibility of the kind Michelle Wu has talked about, which is maybe town by town or school by school. If you have a lot of staff that are out and you send kids to those schools, They're just going to be warehoused for the day. They're not actually going to be learning anything.
So, Arlene, I actually have some of the sound I think you might be referring to. Governor Baker asserting at this hearing on Tuesday that schools are safe and, yes, sounding quite testy.
Our goal all along has been to make it possible to support communities with respect to their goals and their initiatives around all of this. But the idea that schools aren't safe is just not based on any data.
So,
it's just
Governor,
not.
I'm not going to
let people perpetuate this idea that schools aren't safe, because they are. And it's been proven not just in Massachusetts, but in the U.S. and around the world for the better part of a year and a half.
And John Carroll, that came in an exchange back and forth with State Senator Joanne Comerford, who is chairwoman of the Committee on COVID-19 and Emergency Preparedness and Management, when she was pushing him for state guidelines on mask type and more rigorous student testing. Here she is.
Governor, I understood you're not going to answer this question. I would like to say that on behalf of the Senate, I think public health guidelines and issuing a standard quality mask is a good idea. And then following those up by distributing them. Because in my area, the wealthier districts are getting those higher quality masks. And that's all I'll say.
So two things there, John. One, is Governor Baker angry at educators, at others? Is it coming out in these exchanges? And two, he's focusing on, hey, I just need everybody to know schools are safe. Many of the questioners on Tuesday focusing on just wanting more mandates at the state level, which, of course, is a matter of philosophy on local control versus state control. And people in this Commonwealth disagree on that. Where are you in this intersection, John?
Well, Charlie Baker has been combative with the teachers unions from the very start. And I think that is something that has not helped the situation. There's a story in the Boston Herald today that schools are operating with their windows open. They have to be open 4 inches. And the schools are sending notes home to parents saying, hey, have your kids wear all their clothes to school. You know, two pairs of pants, two sweaters. They have their coats on inside. I mean, that is not an atmosphere or a situation that's conducive to learning when you're just trying to stay warm for the whole day. So there's that issue. I think that Charlie Baker has been way too lax in terms of getting a handle on the COVID situation at this stage. The positivity rate right now, according to reports, is 21%. That's a crazy positivity rate. And I know that a lot of the cases are mild. A lot of the breakthrough cases don't result in hospitalization or death, but some of them do. And I think that Charlie Baker is, first of all, he's the artful dodger. He's always emphasizing the positive and dodging the negative. But also, he's more concerned about his image, I think, than he is concerned about the school system, the teachers, the staff, and the students. And I think he should be held to account for that.
So let's talk also about his moves this week. 26 million new rapid tests, which will begin arriving this week. Those are prioritized for K-12 and other education-oriented uses. Also, 500 more National Guard troops mobilized to send to hospitals, although some hospitals had been using Guard members for a while. And I want to keep that voice in here. So I'm going to go back to Dr. Eric Dixon, who is the CEO of UMass Memorial Healthcare, who was on with us in our Ask the Doctor segment earlier this week, talking about the level of fatigue, you know, needing this kind of help.
You know, to see the people that I've worked with for so long suffering the way they are is incredibly painful. And I mean, they're just exhausted at this point. And yet I have to ask them to keep moving on and to keep taking care of patients, because all indications are we have not seen the peak of this latest third and most impactful surge.
I want to ask the question that I almost feel silly asking, Arlene, because I feel like everyone's asking it all the time. And in crisis, of course you're asking it, but too little too late from the governor. Is there some place he should have moved faster recently?
Well, I think there's two things going on that answer your question. One is on the local control versus state control. I think he supports a traditional Republican mode philosophy of local control, unless they disagree with him. And unless Michelle Wu says, well, I'd like to close some schools. And he says, no, you don't get local control. We won't count the days if you teach the kids remotely. So he can't hide behind the local control is my philosophy, because he's clearly not doing that when it comes to schools. On the hospital front that you just described, it's great that he's ordered more tests, and it's great he's providing National Guard to help. But I bet you, if you asked anyone working in a hospital, would you rather have more National Guard troops, or would you rather have fewer patients so you don't need National Guard troops and have fewer patients because there's a mask mandate and there are vaccine mandates, et cetera? I know, hands down, they would say, give me the mandate so we have fewer patients and then we won't need the National Guard.
John, let me just let you pick up on that.
Well, I think that that's all true. And I think that the media, the news media in particular, I think could play a big role here if they were going to put the microscope on Charlie Baker and to pound away at this. You know, one of the problems with news media in general is that, you know, they tend not to hit the same topic day after day after day, because that's not news. It's not news. But I think that this is one where it should be, you know, above the fold, front page every day, because it is an ongoing issue. It's the biggest issue we have right now. And it's really sort of Charlie Baker going along by guess or by God, hoping that it all works out in the end. And I think that that's something that has to be emphasized on a continuing basis so that it doesn't leave the radar screen and the public is constantly aware of it.
So before we go to break, I'm going to pivot a little. And there was a ton of stuff I was going to have us talk about with the governor and it being in his last year and new moves he's making, reissuing the drugged driving piece of legislation, the commutations from this week. But we've been having such a satisfying conversation in this COVID space. I've been happy to stay there. But in our last minute or so for each of you, Arlene, what do you – is there some crazy big – you know, dude, you're not running again, so you've got nothing left to lose act you'd like to see from the governor this year?
I'd like him to be less cautious. I feel like he's lost his leadership mojo that he had in 2020 when he was really ahead of the curve. And I don't know why he's gotten more cautious, maybe because it feels less pressing now than it did in 2020. But he's got to get it up some more
his mojo, you mean?
Yes.
Yes. We'll just cover you there. You meant his mojo.
Yeah. To be aggressive on mask mandates and on vaccination mandates until we get through this bad period.
Is that the place that he needs to swing for the fences this year, John Carroll? Do you agree? And is there anything else?
Well, the Canadian province of Quebec is just initiating a tax on unvaccinated people. And they haven't said exactly how much it's going to be, but they say it's going to be significant. And there was a big uptick in vaccination shots the day after. They've also, if he really wants to swing for the fences, he can do another thing that Quebec does, which is if you're not vaccinated, you can't buy, as an adult, alcohol or cannabis. And I think that may have had a lot to do with the spike in vaccinations too. That would be swinging for the fences. And let's see if Governor Baker's listening to us today.
Oh my God, I think that's brilliant. You know, the fact of the matter is that health insurance costs are going to go through the roof as a result of all the people that are being hospitalized and sick. And so the question is, should people who refuse to get vaccinated, should they be paying more for their health insurance, their premiums, is a similar question.
Still with us, our panelists this week, Arlene Isaacson of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus and John Carroll, media analyst. We are talking about all kinds of big moves by politicians this week, and we're going to move now to Rachel Rollins, who was sworn in as U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts on Monday, getting death threats but no security detail from U.S. Marshals. Should she? Do you want to see that support? And do you believe that she can align her past reform agenda with the priorities of the U.S. government, or is she in for a big change too? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Arlene Isaacson, should now U.S. attorney, no longer Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, be getting a level of protection that she's not from the federal government?
Well, yes, I believe she should. You know, she was a fabulous DA, a real reformer, who believed that you don't keep doing the same things and expect different results. And unlike all her predecessors, she really recognized the systemic racism, even if it was unintended, that was marbled throughout the justice system. So, and I think that made her controversial because she was willing to acknowledge mistakes made by her predecessors and try to fix them like she did with the drug scandal. So she's been under a lot of attack because of that. And in this crazy time, I think you have to take those threats seriously. And yes, I think she really needs to get some protection from the U.S. Marshals.
So, John, this resonates with me because earlier in the show, you were talking about the level of incivility and virulence in our protest culture, our pushback culture in America right now. Do we need to change our paradigm on keeping people who are reformers safe in general?
Well, I think it would be helpful. I think Rachel Rollins did a good job of sort of juggling her progressive objectives and the public safety. You know, we did not have in Boston, even though there was some relaxation of the of enforcement by the DA when it was Rachel Rollins, we did not have the kind of mayhem that they'd seen in, say, San Francisco, where Walgreens shut down a number of stores because they were being shoplifted constantly by people, and nothing was being done about it. And it was just unsustainable. So I think from that standpoint, she did a good job of balancing things out. But I also think that, you know, she's got a whole different agenda now as a U.S. attorney. And I think that she's going to be in a different position. And she's also answering to a different group of people in the Department of Justice. She was answering to the voters before. Now she's answering to the administration of the Department of Justice. So I think that's going to change some of her approaches to law enforcement in particular, I think, to work more closely with them.
So Arlene, yesterday in a press roundtable, she was very clear. She understood she works for the U.S. Attorney General now and those priorities. But she also said that her reform agenda worked, and maybe as U.S. Attorney, she could bring it to the rest of the state. Here she is.
Well, I believe we have a proof of concept here in Suffolk, and I think it should be brought up to scale for the rest of the Commonwealth. And Boston right now is one of the very few major cities in the United States of America where violent crime is down. And why shouldn't Lowell and Lawrence and Lynn and Holyoke and Springfield and Worcester benefit from the excellent work that the Boston Police, the Mass State Police, Transit, Winthrop, Chelsea and Revere Police do with the Suffolk County DA's office? So when asked, I was humbled and honored.
So two things. One, you know, that statement is true about violent crime in Boston. Two, and we've covered this here on the show before, when she opened her data to an independent academic analysis, it did in fact find a reduction in recidivism when she put her reforms in place. So I just want to put that data out there. Arlene Isaacson, what happens to that reform agenda now? Governor Baker has put Kevin Hayden in as the new Suffolk County DA. Rachel Rollins will have to follow the lead of Attorney General Merrick Garland, who, while a Democrat, has been accused of being somewhat conservative in his priorities.
I think both of those statements are true. And she's been a terrific role model, not just within Suffolk County, but for other DAs. And I know she has inspired other people to run for district attorney. You know, Rahsaan Hall running for in Plymouth County for DA, and people around
the state of the ACLU, just to note.
That's right. And they are going to be reformers along the same line. So I think she's done a terrific job with that. And there's no question she'll bring that into the U.S. Attorney's Office in a very meaningful way. So sure, she has to do what Garland wants, but I doubt he's going to be micromanaging those kinds of details here. And I think he would appreciate someone who has such a good record on recidivism, as you rightly point out, bringing that into his office.
So, John Carroll, before we go to our hubbubs, I do want to pivot for just a second. Those of us in the wonky and media classes watching very carefully this week, thinking there might be an announcement from Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey that she was going to run for governor, it did not come. Does it matter in the everyday lives of Massachusetts voters if and when Maura Healey enters the race?
No, probably not. But it may affect their attitude toward Maura Healey. I mean, she's become sort of the Bay State Mario Cuomo. You may remember back in the early 90s. You know, he was the Hamlet on the Hudson who couldn't figure out whether he wanted to run for president or not. You know, I had a plane gassed up on the tarmac to go to New Hampshire and never got on it. Maura Healey has been dithering, and I understand she was probably waiting for Charlie Baker to announce whether he was going to run for re-election or not. But at this point, you know, she looks like someone who's irresolute. And that doesn't usually play well with the voters. Also, I mean, you know, she's got Marty Walsh in the wings, who reportedly would be interested in running if Maura Healey doesn't. So so I think it would behoove her from a public image standpoint to make a decision, you know, fish or cut bait.
Do you agree, Arlene? Last word to you on this.
Well, I think that she, her campaign advisors have been smart to suggest that she hold off. It allowed her to, once you get into the governor's race, then the microscope is on you. And this way she could fly above it, continue to raise money. And I think it was smart to wait to see when Baker was getting out of the race, because that just changed everything.
All right. So now we do want to leave time for our hubbubs, which are those little stories that caught our attention this week. They can be heart-wrenching, but also sometimes fun. It depends on what you picked. So, John Carroll, what'd you pick?
Well, I've got a sad one. Terry Teachout, the great drama critic and cultural columnist for the Wall Street Journal, died this week. And he had an interesting connection to Boston. Even though he wrote for a national publication, he was very invested in reviewing regional theater. And he was particularly fond of the Lyric Stage Company here in Boston. So one stretch of 18 months, he reviewed three different productions at the Lyric Stage. And it was really refreshing to have someone of his stature and in his position come in and take theater in Boston seriously and you know, basically tell the world about it. So his theater reviews will be missed. He was a great critic, and he had a lively blog, and that will be sorely missed. Rest in peace, Terry Teachout.
Thanks for that, John. Arlene, I think you have a hubbub for us this week, too.
Yes, this is from the Boston Guardian newspaper, where they reported that Boston's Chinatown has finally gotten bilingual street signs. Now, it's not on all the streets yet, only a few of the main streets like Beach, Tyler, Neyland, and Harrison Ave. But it's a great start. I think it's a terrific way to make the city more welcoming to the diverse communities that live here. There'll be a blue sign with the name of the street in Chinese lettering and a green sign on the same pole with the name of the street in English. Now, the folks who live in Chinatown have been asking for these sign changes for a long time, and apparently actually for four separate mayors. And Michelle Wu delivered on that within the first month of her administration. So I think it's wonderful. It's educational, fun, interesting, welcoming, and it's about time.
All right. And for my hubbub, briefly, I brought you puppies and kittens. Well, not really, but I did bring you 17 dogs and 100 cats that the MSPCA, the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, took from the state of Kentucky after the disastrous tornadoes that hit Kentucky in December, killing dozens of people and causing an estimated $18 billion in damage. They took those dogs and cats in. All have now been adopted, according to a report from WCVB Channel 5 this week. My husband calls our dogs little mental health practitioners, so I'm happy that those 17 dogs and 100 cats are now enriching the lives of people here, even though they lost their homes and people in Kentucky lost them. So that's my hubbub for this week. Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, president of Isaacson Political Consultant, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And media analyst John Carroll, always good to have you back. Thanks for joining Week in Review.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.